His dashing soldiery outfit was little more than show, but he did cut a grand and impressive figure. All smiles, Feringel joined her beside the High Watcher. The clergyman began the ceremony, solemnly appointing all gathered as witnesses to the sacred joining. Miralda focused her gaze not on Lord Feringel, but on her family. She hardly heard Kaelor Kristen as he preached through the ceremony. At one point, she was given a chalice of wine to sip, then to hand to Lord Feringel. The birds were singing around them, the flowers were spectacular, the couple handsome and happy. It was the wedding that all the women of Orkney envied. Everyone not in attendance at the ceremony was invited to greet the couple afterward outside the castle's front gate. To those of lesser fortune, the spectacle evoked vicarious pleasure. Except from one person.
"Miralda!"
The cry cut the morning air and sent a flock of gulls rushing out from the cliffs east of the castle. All eyes turned toward the voice from high on a cliff. There stood a lone figure, the unmistakable, saggy-shouldered silhouette of Jacka Schooley.
"Miralda!"
the foolish young man cried again, as if the name had been torn from his heart. Miralda looked to her parents, to her fretting father, then to the face of her soon-to-be husband. "Who is that?" Lord Feringel asked in obvious agitation. Miralda sputtered and shook her head, her expression one of honest disgust. "A fool," she finally managed to say.
"You cannot marry Lord Feringel. Run away with me, I beg you, Miralda."
Jacka took a step precariously close to the edge of the cliff. Lord Feringel, and everyone else, it seemed, stared hard at Miralda. "A childhood friendship," she explained hastily. "A fool, I tell you. A little boy and nothing to be concerned with." Seeing that her words were having little effect, she put her hand on Feringel's forearm and moved very close. "I'm here to marry you because we found a love I never dreamed possible," she said, trying desperately to reassure him.
"Miralda!"
Jacka wailed. Lord Feringel scowled up at the cliff.
"Someone shut the fool up," he demanded. He looked to High Watcher Riston. "Drop a globe of silence on his foolish head."
"Too far,"
Riston replied, shaking his head, though in truth he hadn't even prepared such a spell. At the other end of the garden, Steward Temegast feared where this interruption could lead, so he hustled guards off to silence the loud-mouthed young man. Like Temegast, Miralda was truly afraid, wondering how stupid Jacka would prove to be. Would the idiot say something that could cost Miralda the wedding, that might cost them both their reputations and perhaps their very lives?
"Run away with me, Miralda!" Jacka yelled. "I am your true love!"
"Who is that bastard?" Lord Feringel demanded again, past agitated. "A field worker who thinks he is in love with me," she whispered while the crowd watched the couple. Miralda recognized the danger here, the volatile fires simmering in Feringel's eyes. She looked at him directly and stated flatly, without room for debate, "If you and I were not to be married, if we hadn't found love together, I'd still have nothing to do with that fool." Lord Feringel stared at her a while longer, but he couldn't stay angry after hearing Miralda's honest assessment.
"Shall I continue, my lord?"
High Watcher Riston asked. Lord Feringel held up his hand.
"When the fool is dragged away," he replied.
"Miralda, if you do not come out to me, I shall throw myself to the rocks below,"
Jacka yelled suddenly, and he stepped forward to the rim of the cliff. Several people in the garden gasped, but not Miralda. She stood eyeing Jacka coldly, so angry that she cared little if the fool went through with his threat, because she was certain he wouldn't. He hadn't the courage to kill himself. He wanted only to torture and humiliate her publicly to show up Lord Feringel. This was petty revenge, not love.
"Hold!"
cried a guard, fast approaching Jacka on the cliff. The young man spun around at the call, but as he did so, his foot slipped out from under him, dropping him to his belly. He clawed with his hands, but slid farther out, so that he was hanging in air from the chest down, 100-foot drop to jagged rocks below him. The guard lunged for him, but he was too late.
"Meralda!" came Jacka's last cry, a desperate, wailing howl as he dropped from sight.
Stunned as she was by the sudden dramatic turn, Meralda was torn between disbelieving grief for Jacka and awareness that Feringal's scrutinizing gaze was upon her, watching and measuring her every action. She immediately understood that any failure on her part now would be held against her when the truth of her condition became evident.
"By the gods," she gasped, slapping her hand over her mouth. "Oh, the poor fool."
She turned to Lord Feringal and shook her head, seeming very much at a loss. And surely she was, her heart a jumble of hatred, horror, and remembered passion. She hated Jacka, how she hated him for his reaction to the knowledge that she was pregnant, and hated him even more for his stupidity on this day. Still, she could not deny those remembered feelings, the way the mere sight of Jacka had put such a spring in her step just a few short months before. Meralda knew that Jacka's last cry would haunt her for the rest of her life. She hid all of that, and reacted as those around her did to the gruesome sight. With shock and horror, they postponed the wedding. 3 days later, they would complete the ceremony on a gray and thickly overcast morning. It seemed fitting. Meralda felt the hesitance in her husband's movements for the rest of the day during the grand celebration that was open to all of Orkney. She tried to approach Feringal about it, but he would not reveal himself. Meralda understood he was afraid. And why wouldn't Feringal be afraid? Jacka had died crying out to Feringal's wife-to-be. But still, as the wine flowed and the merriment continued, Lord Feringal managed more than a few smiles. How those smiles widened when Meralda whispered into his ear that she could hardly wait for their first night together, the consummation of their love. In truth, the young woman was excited by the prospect, if not a bit fearful. He would recognize, of course, that her virginity wasn't intact, but that was not such an uncommon thing among women living in the harsh farming environment, working hard, often riding horses, and could be explained away. She wondered if perhaps it might be better to reveal the truth of her condition and the lie she had concocted to explain it. No, she decided, even as she and her husband ascended the staircase to their private quarters. No. The man had been through enough turmoil in the last few days. This would be a night for his pleasure, not his pain. She would see to that. It was a grand first 10 days of marriage, full of love and smiles, and those of Beasta Ganderlay touched Meralda most of all. Her family had not come to live with her at Castle Auk. She wouldn't dare suggest such a thing to Priscilla, not yet. But High Watcher Riston had worked tirelessly with Meralda's mother and had declared the woman completely cured. Meralda could see the truth of it painted clearly on Beasta's beaming face. She could see, too, that, though still shaken by Jacka's act upon the cliff, Feringal would get by the event. The man loved her, of that she was sure, and he fawned over her constantly. Meralda had come to terms with her own feelings for Jacka. She was sorry for what had happened, but she carried no guilt for the man's death. Jacka had done it to himself, and for himself, and surely not for her. Meralda understood now that Jacka had done everything for himself. There would always be a tiny place in her heart for the young man, for the fantasies that would never be. But it was more than compensated for by the knowledge that her family would be better off than any of them could ever have hoped. Eventually, she'd move Beasta and Doni into the castle or a proper estate of their own, and she'd help Tori find a suitable husband, a wealthy merchant perhaps, when the girl was ready. There remained only one problem. Miralda feared that Priscilla was catching on to her condition, for the woman, though outwardly pleasant, had cast her a few unmistakable glances. Suspicious glances like those of Steward Temegast. They knew of her condition or suspected it. In any case, they would all know soon enough, which brought a measure of desperation creeping into Miralda's otherwise perfect existence. Miralda had even thought of going to High Watcher Riston to see if there was some magic that might rid her of the child. She had dismissed that thought almost immediately, however, and not for any fears that Riston would betray her. While she wanted no part of Jacka Schooley, she couldn't bring herself to destroy the life that was growing within her. By the end of the first 10 days of her marriage, Miralda had determined the only course open to her, and by the end of the second 10 days she had mustered the courage to initiate her plan. She asked the cook to prepare eggs for breakfast and waited at the table with Feringal, Priscilla, and Temegast. Better to get it over with all of them at once. Even before the cook came out with the eggs, the smell of the food drifted into Miralda and brought that usual queasy feeling to her. She bent over and clutched at her belly. "Miralda?" Feringal asked with concern. "Are you all right, child?" Temegast added. Miralda looked across the table to Priscilla and saw suspicion there. She came up fast with a wail and began crying immediately. It was not hard for Miralda to bring forth those tears. "No, I am not all right," she cried. "What is it, dearest?" Lord Feringal asked, leaping up and running to her side. "On the road," Miralda explained between sobs, "to Madame Prinkle's."
"When you were attacked?" Steward Temegast supplied gently.
"The man, the big one," Miralda wailed. "He ravished me."
Lord Feringal fell back as if struck.
"Why did you not tell us?"
Temegast demanded after a hesitation that seemed to hit all three of them. Indeed, the cook, entering with Miralda's breakfast plate, dropped it to the floor in shock.
"I feared to tell you," Miralda wailed, looking to her husband. "I feared you'd hate me."
"Never,"
Feringal insisted. But he was obviously shaken to the core, and he made no move to come back to his wife's side.
"Are you telling us now because—"
Priscilla's tone and Temegast's wounded expression revealed to the young woman that they both knew the answer.
"Because I'm with child, I fear,"
Miralda blurted. Overwhelmed by her own words and the smell of those damned eggs, she leaned to the side and vomited. Miralda heard Feringal's cry of despair through her own coughs, and it truly hurt the woman to wound him so. Then there came only silence. Miralda, finished with the sickness, feared to sit up straight, feared to face the three. She didn't know what they would do. Though she had heard of a village woman who had become pregnant through rape, that woman had not been held to blame. A comforting hand gripped her shoulder and eased her out of the chair. Priscilla hugged Miralda close and whispered softly into her ear that it would be all right.
"What am I to do?"
Lord Feringal stuttered, hardly able to speak through the bile in his throat. His tone made Miralda think that he might banish her from the castle, from his life then and there. Steward Temegast moved to support the young man.
"This is not without precedence, my lord," the old man explained, "even in your own kingdom."
All three stared at the steward.
"There is no betrayal here, of course," Temegast went on, "except that Miralda did not immediately tell us. For that you may punish her as you see fit, though I pray you will be generous toward the frightened girl."
Feringal looked at Miralda hard, but he nodded just a bit.
"As for the child," Temegast went on, "it must be announced openly and soon. It will be made clear and binding that this child will not be heir to your throne."
"I will slay the babe as it is born,"
Lord Feringal said with a growl. Miralda wailed, as did Priscilla, to Miralda's absolute surprise.
"My lord,"
said Steward Temegast. Feringel punched his fists against the sides of his legs in utter frustration. Meralda noted his every movement then, and recognized that his claim of murder was pure bluster. Steward Temegast just shook his head and walked over to pat Lord Feringel's shoulder.
"Better to give the babe to another," he said. "Let it be gone from your sight and from your lives."
Feringel stared questioningly at his wife.
"I'm not wanting it."
Meralda answered that look with an honest answer.
"I'm not wanting to think at all of that night, time."
She bit her lip as she finished, hoping that her slip of the tongue had not been detected. To her relief and continued surprise, it was Priscilla who stayed close to her, who escorted her to her room. Even when they were out of earshot of Temegast and Lord Feringel, the older woman's gentle demeanor did not waver in the least.
"I cannot guess your pain," Priscilla said. "I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner."
Priscilla patted her cheek.
"It must have been too painful," she offered. "But you did nothing wrong. My brother was still your first lover, the first man to whom you gave yourself willingly, and a husband can ask no more than that."
Meralda swallowed the guilt she felt, swallowed it and pushed it aside with the justification that Feringel was indeed her first true lover, the first man she'd lain with who had honest feelings for her.
"Perhaps we will come to some agreement when the child is born," Priscilla said unexpectedly.
Meralda looked at her strangely, not quite catching on.
"I was thinking that perhaps it would be better if I found another place to live," Priscilla explained. "Or took a wing of the castle for myself, perhaps, and made it my own."
Meralda squinted in puzzlement. Then it hit her. She was so shocked that her previous peasant dialect came rushing back.
"You're thinking of taking the babe for yourself?" she blurted.
"Perhaps, if we could agree," Priscilla said hesitantly.
Meralda had no idea of how to respond, but suspected she wouldn't know until after the child was born. Would she be able to have the baby anywhere near her? Or would she find that she could not part with an infant that was hers after all? No, she decided, not that. She would not, could not keep the child, however she might feel after its birth.
"We planned too far ahead," Priscilla remarked,
as if reading Meralda's mind.
"For now, we must make sure you eat well. You are my brother's wife now, and we'll give him heirs to the throne of Orkney. We must keep you healthy until then."
Meralda could hardly believe the words, the genuine concern. She had never expected this level of success with her plan, which only made her feel even more guilty about it all. And so it went for several days, with Meralda believing that things were on a steady course. There were a few rough spots, particularly in the bedroom, where she had to constantly assuage her husband's pride, insisting that the barbarian who had savaged her had given her no pleasure at all. She even went to the extent of claiming that she was practically unconscious throughout the ordeal, and wasn't even sure it had happened until she came to realize that she was with child. Then one day, Meralda encountered an unexpected problem with her plan.
"Highwaymen do not travel far," she heard Lord Feringel tell Temegast as she joined the two in the drawing room.
"Certainly the scoundrels are nowhere near Orkney," the steward replied.
"Close enough," Feringel insisted. "The merchant Galway has a powerful wizard for hire."
"Even wizards must know what to look for," Temegast remarked.
"I don't remember his face,"
Meralda blurted, hurrying to join them.
"But Liam Woodgate does," said Feringel,
wearing the smug smile of one who intended to find his revenge. Meralda worked very hard to not appear distressed. Chapter 21 The Bane of Any Thief. The little creature scrambled over the rocks, descending the steep slope as if death itself were chasing it.
with an outraged Wolfgar close behind, roaring in pain from his reopened shoulder wound, the goblin would have had better odds against death. The trail ended at a 15-foot drop, but the goblin's run didn't end there as it leaped with hardly a thought. Landing with a thump and a rather sorry attempt at a roll, it got back up, bloody but still moving. Wolfgar didn't follow. He couldn't afford to take himself so far from the cave entrance where Morik was still battling. The barbarian skidded to a stop and searched about for a rock. Snatching one up, he heaved it at the fleeing goblin. He missed, the goblin too far away, but satisfied that it wouldn't return, Wolfgar turned and sprinted back to the cave. Long before he arrived there, though, he saw that the battle had ended. Morik was perched on a rock at the base of a jagged spur of stones, huffing and puffing. "The little rats run fast," Morik remarked. Wolfgar nodded and fell into a sitting position on the ground. They had gone out to scout the pass earlier. Upon returning, they'd found a dozen goblins determined to take the cave home as their own. 12 against 2. The goblins hadn't had a chance. Only one of the goblins was dead. One Wolfgar had caught first by the throat and squeezed. The others had been sent running to the four winds, and both men knew that none of the cowardly creatures would return for a long, long time. "I did get its purse, if not its heart," Morik remarked, holding up a little leather bag. He blew into his empty hand for luck, and also because the mountain wind whistled chilly that day, then emptied the bag, his eyes wide. Wolfgar, too, leaned in eagerly. A pair of silver pieces, several copper and 3 shiny stones. Not gemstones, just stones tumbled out.
"Our luck that we did not encounter a merchant on the path," Wolfgar muttered sarcastically. "Well, this is a richer haul by far."
Morik flung the meager treasure to the ground.
"We still have plenty of gold from the raid on the coach in the west," he remarked.
"So nice to hear you admit it," came an unexpected voice from above.
The pair looked up the rocky spur to see a man in flowing blue robes and holding a tall oaken staff staring down at them.
"I would hate to believe I'd found the wrong thieves after all."
"A wizard," Morik muttered with disgust tensing. "I hate wizards."
The robed man lifted his staff and began chanting. Wolfgar moved quicker, skidding down to scoop a fair-sized stone, then coming up fast and launching it. His aim proved perfect. The rock crashed against the wizard's chest, though it harmlessly bounced away. If the man even noticed it, he showed no sign.
"I hate wizards," Morik yelled again, diving out of the way.
Wolfgar started to move, but he was too late, for the lightning bolt firing from the staff clipped him and sent him flying. Up came Wolfgar, rolling and cursing, a rock in each hand.
"How many hits can you take?" he cried to the wizard, letting fly one that narrowly missed.
The second one went spinning into the obviously amused wizard's blocking arm and bounced away as surely as if it had hit solid stone.
"Does everybody in all of Faerun have access to a wizard?"
Morik cried, picking his trail from cover to cover as he tried to ascend the spur. Morik believed he could get away from, outwit, or outfight, particularly with Wolfgar beside him, any bounty hunter or warrior lord in the area. However, wizards were an entirely different matter, as he had learned so many painful times before, most recently in his capture on the streets of Luskan.
"How many can you take?"
Wolfgar yelled again, hurling another stone that also missed its mark.
"One,"
the wizard replied.
"I can take but one."
"Then hit him," Morik yelled to Wolfgar, misunderstanding.
The wizard was not talking about taking hits on his magical stone skin, but about taking prisoners. Even as Morik cried out, the robed man pointed at Wolfgar with his free hand. A black tendril shot from his extended fingers, snaking down the spur at tremendous speed to wrap around Wolfgar, binding him fast to the mage.
"I'll not leave the other unscathed,"
the wizard cried to no one present. He clenched his fist, his ring sparkled, and he stamped his staff on the stone. A blinding light, a puff of smoke, and Wolfgar and the mage were gone amidst a thunderous rumble along the spur.
"Wizards!"
Morik spat with utter contempt, just before the spur, with Morik halfway up it, collapsed. He was in the audience hall of a castle. The incessant black tendril continued to wrap him stubbornly in its grip, looping his torso several times, trying to pin his powerful arms. Wulfgar punched at it, but it was a pliable thing, and it merely bent under the blows, absorbing all the energy. He grabbed at the tendril, tried to twist and tear it, but even as his hands worked one area, the long end of the tendril, released from the wizard's hand, looped his legs and tripped him up, bringing him crashing to the hard floor. Wulfgar rolled and squirmed and wriggled to no avail. He was caught. The barbarian used his arms to keep the thing from wrapping his neck, and when he was at last sure that it could not harm him, he turned his attention more fully to the area around him. There stood the wizard before a pair of chairs, wherein sat a man in his mid-twenties and a younger, undeniably beautiful woman. A woman Wulfgar recognized all too well. Beside them stood an old man, and in a chair to the side sat a plump woman of perhaps 40 winters. Wulfgar also noted that several soldiers lined the room, grim-faced and well-armed. "As I promised," the wizard said, bowing before the man on the throne. "Now, if you please, there is the small matter of my payment."
"You will find the gold awaiting you in the quarters I provided," the man replied. "I never doubted you, good sir. Your merchant mentor Galway recommended you most highly."
The wizard bowed again.
"Are my services further required?" he asked.
"How long will it last?" the man asked, indicating the tendril holding Wulfgar.
"A long time," the wizard promised. "Long enough for you to question and condemn him, certainly, then to drag him down to your dungeon or kill him where he lies."
"Then you may go. Will you dine with us this night?"
"I fear that I have pressing business at the host tower," the wizard replied. "Well met, Lord Feringal."
He bowed again and walked out, chuckling as he passed the prone barbarian. To everyone's surprise, Wulfgar growled and grabbed the tendril in both hands and tore it apart. He had just managed to gain his feet, many voices screaming around him, when a dozen soldiers descended, pounding him with mailed fists and heavy clubs. Still fighting against the tendril, Wulfgar managed to free his hand for one punch, sending a soldier flying, and to grab another by the neck and slam him face down on the floor. Wulfgar went down, dazed and battered. As the wizard magically dispelled the remnants of the tendril, the barbarian's arms were brought behind him and looped with heavy chains.
"If it were just you and me, wizard, would you have anything left with which to stop me?" the stubborn barbarian growled.
"I would have killed you out in the mountains," snapped the mage,
obviously embarrassed by the failure of his magic. Wulfgar launched a ball of spit that struck the man in the face.
"How many can you take?" he asked.
The enraged wizard began waggling his fingers, but before he could get far, Wulfgar plowed through the ring of soldiers and shoulder-slammed the man, sending him flying away. The barbarian was subdued again almost immediately, but the shaken wizard climbed up from the floor and skittered out of the room.
"Impressive display," Lord Feringal said sarcastically, scowling. "Am I to applaud you before I castrate you?"
That got Wulfgar's attention. He started to respond, but a guard slugged him to keep him quiet. Lord Feringal looked to the young woman seated beside him.
"Is this the man?"
he asked, venom in every word. Wulfgar stared hard at the woman, at the woman he had stopped Morik from harming on the road, at the woman he had released unscathed. He saw something there in her rich green eyes, some emotion he could not quite fathom. Sorrow, perhaps. Certainly not anger.
"I don't think so,"
the woman said and looked away. Lord Feringal's eyes widened indeed. The old man standing beside him gasped openly, as did the other woman.
"Look again, Meralda," Feringal commanded sharply. "Is it him?"
No answer, and Wulfgar could clearly see the pain in the woman's eyes.
"Answer me," the Lord of Orkney demanded. "No," the woman cried, refusing to meet any gaze. "Fetch Liam," Lord Feringhal yelled. Behind Wulfgar, a soldier rushed out of the room, returning a moment later with an old gnome.
"Oh, be sure it is," the gnome said, coming around to stare Wulfgar right in the eye. "You thinking I won't know you?" he asked. "You got me good, with your little rat friend distracting my eyes and you swinging down. I know you, thieving dog, for I seen you afore you hit me."
He turned to Lord Feringhal.
"Aye,"
he said,
"he's the one."
Feringhal eyed the woman beside him for a long, long time. "You are certain?" he asked Liam, his eyes still on the woman.
"I've not been bested often, my lord," Liam replied. "You've named me as the finest fighter in Orkney, which is why you entrusted me with your lady. I failed you, and I'm not taking that lightly. He's the one, I say, and oh, but what I'd pay you to let me fight him fairly."
He turned back and glared into Wulfgar's eyes. Wulfgar matched that stare, and though he had no doubt he could snap this gnome in half with hardly an effort, he said nothing. Wulfgar couldn't escape the fact that he had wronged the diminutive fellow. "Have you anything to say for yourself?" Lord Feringhal asked Wulfgar. Before the barbarian could begin to reply, the young lord rushed forward, brushing Liam aside to stand very close. "I have a dungeon for you," he whispered harshly. "A dark place, filled with the waste and bones of the previous occupants. Filled with rats and biting spiders. Yes, fool, I have a place for you to rot until I decide the time has come to kill you most horribly." Wulfgar knew the procedure well by this point in his life, and merely heaved a heavy sigh. He was promptly dragged away. In the corner of the audience hall, Steward Temegast watched it all very carefully, shifting his gaze from Wulfgar to Miralda and back again. He noted Priscilla sitting quietly, no doubt taking it all in as well. He noted the venom on Priscilla's face as she regarded Miralda. She was thinking that the woman had enjoyed being ravished by the barbarian, Temegast realized. She was thinking that perhaps it hadn't really been a rape. Given the size of the man, Temegast couldn't agree with that assessment. The cell was everything Lord Feringhal had promised, a wretched, dark, damp place filled with the awful stench of death. Wulfgar couldn't see a thing, not his own hand if he held it an inch in front of his face. He scrabbled around in the mud and worse, pushing past sharp bones in a futile attempt to find some piece of dry ground upon which he might sit. And all the while he slapped at the spiders and other crawling things that scurried in to learn what new meal had been delivered to them. To most, this dungeon would have seemed worse than Luskin's prison tunnels, mostly because of its purest sense of emptiness and solitude. But Wulfgar feared neither rats nor spiders. His terrors ran much deeper than that. Here in the dark, he found he was somewhat able to fend off those horrors. And so the day passed. Sometime during the next one, the barbarian awoke to torchlight and the sound of a guard slipping a plate of rotten food through the small slit in the half-barred, half-metal hatch that sealed the filthy burrow cell from the wet tunnels beyond. Wulfgar started to eat, but spat it out, thinking he might be better off trying to catch and skin a rat. The second day, a turmoil of emotions found the barbarian. Mostly, he was angry at all the world. Perhaps he deserved punishment for his highwayman activities. He could accept responsibility for that. But this went beyond justice concerning his actions on the road with Lord Feringhal's coach. Also, Wulfgar was angry at himself. Perhaps Morek had been right all along. Perhaps he did not have the heart for this life. A true highwayman would have let the gnome die, or at least finished him quickly. A true highwayman would have taken his pleasures with a woman, then dragged her along either to be sold as a slave or kept as a slave of his own. Wulfgar laughed aloud. Yes, indeed, Morek had been right. Wulfgar hadn't the heart for any of it.
Now here he was, the wretch of wretches, a failure at the lowest level of civilized society, a fool too incompetent to even be a proper highwayman. He spent the next hour not in his cell, but back in the spine of the world, that great dividing line between who he once was and what he had become, that physical barrier that seemed such an appropriate symbol of the mental barrier within him, the wall he had thrown up like an emotional mountain range to hold back the painful memories of Ertu. In his mind's eye he was there now, sitting on the spine of the world, staring out over Icewind Dale and the life he once knew, then turning around to face south and the miserable existence he now suffered. He kept his eyes closed, though he wouldn't have seen much in the dark anyway, ignored the many crawling things assaulting him, and got more than a few painful spider bites for his inattentiveness. Sometime later that day, a noise brought him from his trance. He opened his eyes to see the flickers of another torch in the tunnel beyond his door.
"Living still?" came a question from the voice of an old man.
Wulfgar shifted to his knees and crawled to the door, blinking repeatedly as his eyes adjusted to the light. After a few moments he recognized the man holding the torch as the advisor Wulfgar had seen in the audience hall, a man who physically reminded him of Magistrate Jarkeld of Luskin. Wulfgar snorted and squeezed one hand through the bars.
"Burn it with your torch," he offered. "Take your perverted pleasures where you will find them." "Angry that you were caught, I suppose," the man called Temegast replied. "Twice imprisoned wrongly," Wulfgar replied.
"Are not all prisoners imprisoned wrongly by their own recounting?" the steward asked.
"The woman said it wasn't me."
"The woman suffered greatly," Temegast countered. "Perhaps she cannot face the truth."
"Or perhaps she spoke correctly."
"No,"
Temegast said immediately, shaking his head.
"Liam remembered you clearly and would not be mistaken."
Wulfgar snorted again.
"You deny that you were the thief who knocked over the carriage?" Temegast asked bluntly.
Wulfgar stared at him unblinking, but his expression spoke clearly that he did not deny the words.
"That alone would cost you your hands and imprison you for as many years as Lord Feringal decided was just,"
Temegast explained.
"Or that alone could cost you your life."
"Your driver, Liam, was injured,"
Wulfgar replied, his voice a growl.
"Accidentally. I could have let him die on the road. The girl was not harmed in any way."
"Why would she say differently?"
Temegast asked calmly.
"Did she?"
Wulfgar came back, and he tilted his head, beginning to catch on, beginning to understand why the young lord had been so completely outraged. At first he had thought mere pride to be the source. The man had failed to properly protect his wife, after all. But now, in retrospect, Wulfgar began to suspect there had been something even deeper there, some primal outrage. He remembered Lord Feringal's first words to him, a threat of castration.
"I pray that Lord Feringal has a most unpleasant death prepared for you, barbarian,"
Temegast remarked.
"You cannot know the agony you have brought to him, to Lady Miralda, or to the folk of Orkney. You are a scoundrel and a dog, and justice will be served when you die, whether in public execution or down here alone in the filth."
"You came down here just to deliver this news?"
Wulfgar asked sarcastically. Temegast struck him in the hand with a lit torch, forcing Wulfgar to quickly retract his arm. With that, the old man turned and stormed away, leaving Wulfgar alone in the dark and with some very curious notions swirling around in his head. Despite his final outburst and genuine anger, Temegast didn't walk away with his mind made up about anything. He had gone to see the barbarian because of Miralda's reaction to the man in the audience hall, because he had to learn the truth. Now that truth seemed fuzzier by far. Why wouldn't Miralda identify Wulfgar if she had indeed recognized him? How could she not? The man was remarkable, after all, being near to 7 feet in height and with shoulders as broad as a young giant's. Priscilla was wrong, Temegast knew, for he recognized that she was thinking that Miralda had enjoyed the rape.
"Ridiculous," the steward muttered, verbalizing his thoughts that he might make some sense of them. "Purely and utterly ridiculous."
"But would Miralda protect her rapist?" he asked himself quietly. The answer hit him as clearly as the image of an idiotic young man slipping off a cliff.
Chapter 22
Good Lord Brandenburg.
"I hate wizards," Morrick muttered, crawling out of the rubble of the slide, a dozen cuts and bruises decorating his body. "Not really a fair fight. I must learn this spell-casting business."
The rogue spent a long while surveying the area, but of course Wulfgar was nowhere to be found. The wizard's choice in taking Wulfgar seemed a bit odd to Morrick. Likely the man thought Wulfgar the more dangerous of the two foes, probably the leader. But it had been Morrick, and surely not Wulfgar, who had made an attempt at the lady in the carriage. Wulfgar was the one who had insisted that they let her go, and quickly enough to save the wounded driver. Obviously, the wizard had not come well informed. Now where was Morrick to turn? He went back to the cave first, tending his wounds and collecting the supplies he would need for the road. He didn't want to stay here, not with an angry band of goblins nearby and Wulfgar gone from his side. But where to go? The choice seemed obvious after but a moment's serious thought. Back to Luskin. Morrick had always known he would venture back to the streets he knew so well. He'd concoct a new identity as far as most were concerned. But he'd remain very much the same intimidating rogue to those whose alliance he needed. The snag in his plans thus far had been Wulfgar. Morrick couldn't walk into Luskin with a huge barbarian beside him and hope to maintain secrecy for any length of time. Of course, there was also the not-so-little matter of dark elves. Even that potential problem didn't hold up, though, for Morrick had done his best to remain with Wulfgar, as he had been instructed. Now Wulfgar was gone and the way was left open. Morrick took the first steps out of the spine of the world, heading back for the place he knew so well. But something very strange happened just then to Morrick's sensibilities. The rogue found himself taking 2 steps westward for every 1 south. It was no trick of the wizard, but a spell cast by his own conscience, a spell of memory that whispered the demands Wulfgar had placed on Captain Dudermont at Prisoner's Carnival, that Morrick too must be set free. Bound by friendship for the first time in his miserable life, Morrick the rogue was soon trotting along the road, sorting out his plan. He camped on the side of a mountain that night and spotted the campfire of a group of circled wagons. He wasn't far from the main northern pass. The wagons had come from 10 towns, no doubt, and were on the road to the south, thus wouldn't go anywhere near to the fiefdom in the west. It was unlikely these merchants had ever heard of the place.
"Greetings," Morrick called to the lone sentry later that night.
"Stand fast,"
the man called back. Behind him the others scrambled.
"I am no enemy," Morrick explained. "I am a wayward adventurer, separated from my group, wounded a bit, but more angry than hurt."
After a short discussion, which Morrick could not hear, another voice announced that he could approach, but it warned that 12 archers were trained on his heart, and he would be wise to keep his palms showing empty. Wanting no part of a fight, Morrick did just that, walking through 2 lines of armed men into the firelight to stand before 2 middle-aged merchants, one a great bear of a man, the other leaner, but still quite sturdy.
"I am Lord Brandenburg of Waterdeep," Morrick began, "returning to 10 towns, to Mare Duwalden, where I hope to find some remaining sport fishing for Knucklehead. Fun business, that."
"You are a long way from anywhere, Lord Brandenburg," the heavier merchant replied.
"Late in the year to be out on Mare Duwalden,"
the other replied, suspicious.
"Yet that is where I am going, if I find my playful, wandering friends,"
Morik replied with a laugh.
"Perchance you have seen them. A dwarf, Brunner Battlehammer by name, his human daughter Catti Bree. Oh, but the sun itself bows before her beauty. A rather fat halfling and—"
Morik hesitated, and appeared somewhat nervous suddenly, though the smiles of recognition on the faces of the merchants were exactly what he had hoped to see.
"And a dark elf," the heavy man finished for him. "Go ahead and speak openly of Drizdo Erden, Lord Brandenburg. Well known he is, and no enemy of any merchant crossing into the Dale."
Morik sighed with feigned relief, and silently thanked Wulfgar for telling him so much of his former friends during their drinking binges over the last few days.
"Well met, I say to you," the heavy man continued. "I am Petters, and my associate, good man De Winkle."
On a motion from Petters, the guards behind Morik relaxed, and the trio settled into seats around the fire, where Morik was handed a bowl of thick stew.
"Back to Icewind Dale, you say?" De Winkle asked. "How have you lost that group? No trouble, I pray."
"More a game," Morik answered. "I joined them many miles to the south, and perhaps in my ignorance I got a little forward with Catti Bree."
Both merchants scowled darkly.
"Nothing serious, I assure you," Morik quickly added. "I was unaware that her heart was for another, an absent friend, nor did I realize that Grumbling Brunner was her father. I merely requested a social exchange, but that, I fear, was enough to make Brunner wish to pay me back."
The merchants and guards laughed now. They had heard of surly and overprotective Brunner Battlehammer, as had anyone who spent time in Icewind Dale.
"I fear that I bragged of some tracking, some ranger skills," Morik continued. "And so Brunner decided to test me. They took my horse, my fine clothes, and disappeared from the road, so well into the brush, led by Drizzt, that one not understanding the dark elf's skills would think they had magical aid."
The merchants bobbed their heads, laughing still.
"So now I must find them, though I know they are already nearing Icewind Dale."
He chuckled at himself.
"I'm sure they'll laugh when I arrive on foot, wearing soiled and tattered clothing."
"You look as if you've had a fight,"
De Winkle remarked, noticing the signs of the landslide and the goblin battle.
"A row with a few goblins and a single ogre, nothing serious," the rogue replied nonchalantly.
The men raised their eyebrows, but not in doubt. Never that for someone who had traveled with those powerful companions. Morik's charm and skill was such that he understood how to weave tales beneath tales beneath tales, but the basic premise became quickly accepted as fact.
"You are welcome to spend the night, good sir," Merchant Petters offered, "or as many nights as you choose. We are returning to Luskan, though, the opposite direction from your intended path."
"I will accept the bet this night," Morik replied, "and perhaps—"
He let the words hang in the air, bringing his fingers to his lips in a pensive pose. Both Petters and De Winkle leaned forward in anticipation.
"Would you know where I might purchase a horse, a fine riding horse?" Morik asked. "Perhaps a set of fine clothing as well. My friends have left the easy road, and so I might still beat them to 10 towns. But wondrous expressions I might paint on their faces when they enter Lonelywood to find me waiting and looking grand indeed."
The men around him howled.
"Why, we have both horse and clothing,"
Petters roared, sliding over to slap Morik on the shoulder, which made him wince because he had been battered there by rocks.
"A fine price we shall offer to Lord Brandenburg."
They ate, they exchanged stories, and they laughed. By the time he finished with the group, Morik had procured their strongest riding horse and a wondrous set of clothing, 2-toned green of the finest material with gold brocade, for a mere pittance, a fraction of the cost in any shop in Luskan. He stayed with them through the night, but left at first light, riding north and singing a song of adventure.
When the caravan was out of sight, he turned to the west and charged on, thinking that he should further alter his appearance before he, Lord Brandenburg of Waterdeep, arrived in the small fiefdom. He hoped the wizard wouldn't be around. Morik hated wizards. Ertu found him, there, in the darkness of his dungeon cell. Wulfgar could not escape the haunting memories, the emotional agony twisted into his very being by the years of torment at the clawed hands of Ertu and his demonic minions. The demon found him once again and held him, taunted him with alluring mistresses to tempt and destroy him, to destroy, too, the fruit of his seed. He saw it all again so vividly, the demon standing before him, the babe, Wolfgar's child, in its powerful arms. He had been repulsed at the thought that he had sired such a creature, an Alu demon, but he remembered, too, his recognition of that child, innocent child, as his own. Ertu had opened wide his drooling maw, showing those awful canine teeth. The demon's face moved lower, pointed teeth hovering an inch above the head of Wolfgar's child, jaws wide enough to fit the babe's head inside. Ertu moved lower. Wolfgar felt the succubi fingers tickling his body, and he woke with a start. He screamed, kicked, and batted, slapping away several spiders, but taking bites from more. The barbarian scrambled to his feet and ran full out in the pitch darkness of his cell, nearly knocking himself unconscious as he barreled into the unyielding door. He fell back to the dirt floor, sobbing, face buried in his hands, full of anger and frustration. Then he understood what had so startled him from his nightmare-filled sleep. For he heard footsteps out in the corridor. When he looked up, he saw the flickers of a torch approaching his door. Wolfgar moved back and sat up straight, trying to regain some measure of his dignity. He recalled that doomed men were often granted one last request. His would be a bottle of potent drink, a fiery liquid that would burn those memories from his mind for the last time. The light appeared right outside his cell, and Lord Feringel's face stared in at him.
"Are you prepared to admit your crime, dog?" he asked.
Wolfgar stared at him for a long, long moment.
"Very well, then," the unshaken lord continued. "You have been identified by my trusted driver, so by law I need only tell you your crime and punishment."
Still no response. "For the robbery on the road I shall take your hands," Lord Feringel explained matter-of-factly. "One at a time and slowly. For your worst crime," he hesitated, and it seemed to Wolfgar, even in that meager light, as if the man was suddenly pained.
"My lord," prompted old Temegast behind him. "For your worst crime," Lord Feringel began again, his voice was stronger. "For the ravishing of Lady Miralda, you shall be publicly castrated, then chained for public spectacle for one day, and then, dog Wolfgar, you shall be burned at the stake."
Wolfgar's face screwed up incredulously at the reading of the last crime. He had saved the woman from such a fate. He wanted to yell that in Lord Feringel's face, to scream at the man and tear the door from its fitting. He wanted to do all of that. And yet he did nothing. Just sat there quietly, accepting the injustice. Or was it injustice? Wolfgar asked himself. Did he not deserve such a fate? Did it even matter? That was it, Wolfgar decided. It mattered to him not at all. Let Lord Feringel kill him and be done with it, doing them both a favor. The woman had falsely accused him, and he could not understand why, but no matter. "Have you nothing to say?" Lord Feringel demanded.
"Will you grant a final request?"
The young man trembled visibly at the absurd notion. "I would give you nothing," he screamed.
nothing more than a knight, hungry and wretched, to consider your horrid fate.
My lord, Tamagast said again to calm him. Guard, lead Lord Feringo back to his chambers.
The young man scowled one last time at Wulfgar through the opening in the door, then let himself be led away. Tamagast stayed, though, taking one of the torches and waving the remaining guards away. He stood at the cell door for a long while, staring at Wulfgar.
Go away, old man, the barbarian said. You did not deny the last charge, Tamagast said, though you protested your innocence to me.
Wulfgar shrugged, but said nothing, and did not meet the man's gaze.
What would be the point of repeating myself? You've already condemned me.
You did not deny the rape, Tamagast stated again. Wulfgar's head swung up to return Tamagast's stare.
Nor did you speak up for me, he replied.
Tamagast looked at him as if slapped.
Nor shall I.
So you would let an innocent man die?
Tamagast snorted aloud.
Innocent? He declared. You are a thief and a dog, and I'll do nothing against Lady Meralda, nor against Lord Feringal for your miserable sake.
Wulfgar laughed at him, at the ridiculousness of it all.
But I offer you this, Tamagast went on. Say not a word against Lady Meralda, and I will ensure that your death will be quick. That is the best I can offer.
Wulfgar stopped laughing and stared hard at the complicated steward.
Or else, Tamagast warned, I promise to drag the spectacle of your torture out for the length of a day and more. Shall make you beg for your death 1,000,000 times before setting you free of the agony.
Of the agony?
Wulfgar echoed hollowly.
Old man, you know nothing of agony.
We shall see,
Tamagast growled, and he turned away, leaving Wulfgar alone in the dark. Until Ertu returned to him, as the demon always did.
Morik rode fast as his horse would take him, for as long as the poor beast would last. He crossed along the same road where he and Wulfgar had encountered the carriage, past the same spot where Wulfgar had overturned the thing. He came into Orkney late one afternoon to the stares of many peasants.
Pray, tell me the name of your lord, good sir. He called to one, accentuating his request with a tossed gold piece.
Lord Feringalock, the man supplied quickly. He lives with his new bride in Castleock there,
he finished, pointing a gnarly finger toward the coast.
Many thanks. Morik bowed his head, tossed another couple of silver coins, then kicked his horse's flanks, trotting down the last few hundred yards of road to the small bridge leading to Castleock. He found the gate open, with a pair of bored-looking guards standing to either side.
I am Lord Brandenburg of Waterdeep, he said to them, bringing his steed to a stop. Pray announce me to your lord, for I've a long road behind me and a longer one ahead.
With that, the rogue dismounted and brushed off his fine pantaloons, going so far as to draw his slender sword from his belt, wiping clean the blade as he brought it forth, then launching into a sudden, dazzling display of swordsmanship before replacing it on his hip. He had impressed them, he realized, as one ran off for the castle and the other moved to tend his horse. Within the span of a few moments, Morik, Lord Brandenburg, stood before Lord Feringal in the audience hall of Castle Auk. He dipped a low bow and introduced himself as a traveler who had lost his companions to a band of giants in the spine of the world. He could see from Lord Feringal's eyes that the minor nobleman was thrilled and proud to be visited by a lord of the great city of Waterdeep, and would drop his guard in his efforts to please. "I believe that one or two of my friends escaped," Morik finished his tale.
though on my word, not a giant can say the same.
How far away was this? Asked Lord Feringal. The man seemed somewhat distracted, but Morik's tale obviously alarmed him.
Many miles, my lord, Morik supplied, and no threat to your quiet kingdom. As I said, the giants are all dead.
He looked around and smiled.
A pity it would be for such monsters to descend on such a quiet and safe place as this.
Lord Feringal took the bait.
Not so quiet, and not so safe, he growled through clenched teeth.
Danger here? He said incredulously.
Pirates, perhaps? Morik appeared surprised, and looked to the old steward standing beside the throne.
The man shook his head imperceptibly, which Morik took to mean he should not press the issue, but that was exactly the point.
Highwaymen, Lord Feringal snarled.
Morik started to respond, but held his tongue and his breath, as a woman whom Morik surely recognized entered the room.
My wife, Lord Feringal introduced her distractedly. Lady Miralda Auk.
Morik bowed low, took her hand in his and lifted it to his lips, pointedly staring her right in the eyes as he did. To his ultimate relief and pride at his own clever disguise, he detected no flicker of recognition there.
A most beautiful wife, Morik stated. You have my envy, Lord Feringal.
That brought a smile at last to Feringal's face, but it quickly turned into a frown.
My wife was in the coach attacked by these highwaymen.
Morik gasped.
I would find them, Lord Feringal, he said. Find them and slay them on the road, or bring them back to you if you would prefer.
Lord Feringal waved his hands, quieting the man.
I have the one I desire, he said. The other one was buried under a rock slide.
Morik's lips pursed at the painful thought.
A fitting fate, he said. More fitting is the fate I have planned for the captured barbarian, Feringal grimly replied. A most horrible death, I assure you. You may witness it if you will stay in Orkney for the night.
Of course I shall, Morik said. What have you planned for the scoundrel?
First, castration, Lord Feringal explained. The barbarian will be killed properly 2 mornings hence.
Morik assumed a pensive pose.
A barbarian, you say? A huge northerner, yes, Feringal replied.
Strong of arm?
As strong as any man I have ever seen, the Lord of Orkney replied. It took a powerful wizard to bring him to justice, and even that man would have fallen to him had not my guards surrounded him and beat him down.
Morik almost choked over the mention of the wizard, but he held his calm.
Killing a highwayman is surely an appropriate ending, Morik said. But perhaps you would be better served in another manner.
He waited, watching carefully as Lord Feringal eyed him closely.
Perhaps I might purchase the man, Morik explained. I am a man of no small means, I assure you, and could surely use a strong slave at my side as I begin the search for my missing companions.
Not a chance, Feringal replied rather sharply.
But if he is familiar with these parts, Morik started to reason.
He is going to die horribly for the harm he brought to my wife, Lord Feringal retorted.
Ah, yes, my lord, Morik said. The incident has distressed her.
The incident has left her with child, Feringal yelled, grabbing the arms of his chair so forcefully that his knuckles whitened.
My lord, the steward cried at the unwise announcement, and Miralda gasped.
Morik was glad for their shock, as it covered his own.
Lord Feringal calmed quickly, forcing himself back into his seat and mumbling an apology to Miralda.
Lord Brandenburg, I beg your forgiveness, he said. You understand my anger.
I will castrate the dog for you, Morik replied, drawing forth his sword. I assure you that I am skilled at such arts.
That broke the tension in the room somewhat.
Even Lord Feringel managed a smile. "We will take care of the unpleasantries," he replied. "But I would indeed enjoy your company at the execution of sentence. Will you stay as my guest for the 2 days?"
Morrick bowed very low.
"I am at your service, my lord."
Soon after, Morrick was brought to an inn just beyond the castle bridge. He wasn't thrilled to learn that Lord Feringel kept guests outside the castle walls. That would make it all the harder for him to get near Wulfgar. He did learn from the escort, though, that Wulfgar was being kept in a dungeon beneath the castle. Morrick had to get to his friend, and fast, for given the false accusations placed against Wulfgar,